what's going on when all them guns is drawn? Here's a memo. Remember, there's a few wars going on, a couple overseas and on my front lawn, when common sense was common and now it's all gone. What's going on? And that's going on. And what's going on? And that's going on. And what's going on? And that's going on. And that's going on. And that's going on.
About, so let's get to it. This is Free Your Mind Friday. You know what the drill is. You say what's on your mind, and you're prepared to defend your position. It's not about whether you're wrong or right. It's just that we want to appreciate what your point of view is. All righty, let's talk to Joel from New York.
Hi, Atrice. How are you?
Okay. How are you doing, Joel?
I'm fine, thank you. So, Atrice, I was thinking about the program that you had 2 or 3 weeks ago when you played a piece by John Mersheimer, if you recall, about the Israel-Palestine crisis. And I thought about it again as the emergency got worse in Gaza, and today in Gaza, 3 more people were killed and over 300 people were injured. And when the first event happened weeks ago, immediately I thought of the Sharpeville riots in 1960 and Soweto in 1976, which for your younger listeners were two important and significant slaughters that took place in South Africa that are very similar to what's going on in Gaza today. And, I said to myself, what kind of people engage in this kind of activity and then justify it? And I just wanted to briefly talk about something that you never hear about in the mainstream media, but is part of the historical record and sheds light on the attitude that exists in the Zionist colonial settler state today. And that is during the Nazi period in the 1930s, 1934, the Nuremberg Party Rally was held, made famous by Leni Riefenstahl's famous film, which some people may have seen, called Triumph of the Will, filled with elaborate ritual, et cetera, et cetera. And unbeknownst to many, there was a delegation of revolutionaries that came from Mandate Palestine. And they were right-wing revolutionaries, part of the Herhut movement, which were the forerunners to the Likud party, which has been governing Israel for a long time now. And they met with Nazi administrators primarily because one of the great ironies of history was that the Zionists and the Nazis had the same thing in mind in the 1930s, and that is to get out of Europe. The last thing that the Zionists wanted was assimilation into European society, which is why they were so opposed to secular Jews and to the secular assimilation culture that existed in places like Germany and England, the United States and France. And they met with these leaders and they agreed verbally to engage in insurrection against the British. This is when the British had the mandate over Palestine from 1920 to 1948. And they would engage in terrorist activities and revolutionary activities against the Nazis, in return for which the Nazis would promise this group a Jewish state in Palestine once war broke out in Europe. And the Hirhut Jews in Palestine were very prescient because they understood that war was looming and they assumed the Nazis were going to win. And so they made this deal with the Nazis. So if you look at the program and the protocol for the Nuremberg Party rally in 1934, the Nazis say that we have a Jewish problem. This was long before 1942 when they decided upon the final solution during the Second World War. At that time, they just wanted all the Jews out. And they said, we have to, you know, extract the Jews from Europe. They need to find another place to live, and that place is Palestine. So very few people know about this. You can find this in a really excellent book of primary source documents edited by Lanny Brenner, B-R-E-N-N-E-R, called 33 Documents, where all of this is laid out in bold detail. And it says something, I think, about the Israeli state, because over the years, they have helped the United States in their counter-revolutionary activities in Latin America and Africa. They advised the right wing in Guatemala, in El Salvador. They supported the Contras in Nicaragua, and they offered a lot of support, advice and support, tactical support to the Americans in Vietnam, and they supported that CIA stooge Jonas Savimbi, who was trying to repress the freedom fighters in Angola. So this is a story that you'll never hear in the mainstream media in the United States, but it's part of history and it sheds light on the character of Israel.
Well, thank you to get us started this way today with a historical note. Thanks so much, Joel, for your call. 888-874-4888. We go next to Chicago. Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Truth, how's it going?
I'm hanging in. How's by you, as they say?
Same here, hanging in. greetings to you and all the PRN listeners. Hopefully everybody has a great weekend. I wanted to take the topic locally. There's some developments here in Chicago I wanted to present to you. And I want to get your opinion on this, because I think it might be something that might be viable, but we'll see. So, as you know, next year is the big mayoral race, 2019. So far we've had a pool of candidates that have declared to run for mayor of Chicago. This including the current mayor, Rahm Emanuel, also who have put their names in the hat have been Paul Vallis, who was the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, and also to Gary McCarthy, who was the former chief of police here in Chicago, and what most people know him infamously is he was the chief of police during the Laquan McDonald murder and was blamed for it and was subsequently fired by Rahm Emanuel. And now he wants to come back and run against Rahm Emanuel. But what is also interesting is there have been a pool of African-American candidates that have put their names in the hat. Dorothy Brown, who was a Cook County commissioner, and a couple of other people that probably aren't known on the national scene as well. But what's interesting is the black community here has noticed this pool of black candidates that are pouring in. And we have a feeling that a lot of these candidates are there to kind of split the black vote in Chicago. So what's interesting is there's one grassroots organization that I've worked with. They have set up a series of what they call town hall meetings with these candidates, because what they want to do is they want to basically get an idea of what these candidates, you know, what these candidates can do, and if they are viable to be, you know, to viable to win this election. So what they want to do is they want to set up a series of town halls with these candidates, and at the end of the series, they want to determine if there is one candidate that, you know, all, you know, most of Black Chicago can get behind. And what is also interesting is all of these candidates have agreed to be in these town hall meetings with the people. And they also, well, I would say some of them have verbally agreed that if they feel at the end of these series that if they're not the viable candidate and they see somebody that might be able to win, that they will get behind them. Now, I think this is a great idea because I don't think that we, you know, we need all these candidates in the pool, and we should just get one candidate and back them up, you know, if they come. And I've participated in the first session, and, you know, it was okay. They did ask, you know, the questions that were presented to them, like, you know, can you handle the multi-million-dollar budget? You know, do you think, you know, and one of the questions was, if you feel that that there is a more worthy opponent to run for mayor, would you back them up? And, you know, most of them gave a response of yes, but, you know, I don't know technically what they'll do. So I want to get your opinion on this because I think it's a good idea, but do you think this is a little too late since the election is going to be next year?
Well, you didn't mention one name that I was expecting you to mention, and that's Chuy Garcia.
Yeah, Chuy declined. He's not running.
He's declined. Okay.
Yeah.
And even though he has declined, is he backing somebody?
We don't actually know yet.
So you have a real possibility that the mayor you have now, you may see him again.
It's possible, but, you know, this is a strategy that I have not seen in a long time, since the Harold Washington days. I mean, this is the last time I've seen this happen, because there were a number of Black candidates that wanted to run for mayor when Harold ran. But what happened was Black Chicago kind of did this same technique where they kind of vetted out the other Black candidates and then decided that this is the guy we want to support, which was Harold Washington. Because if you notice, Harold Washington had no other Black candidates running against him. It was Harold. He was the only Black candidate in the field.
Because he was also the strongest, and he was
exactly
one who worked the hardest to build a base.
Exactly. And even back then, he was also vetted out as well as the one who was viable to run for Chicago mayor.
Well, you know, I hate to be pessimistic, but it sounds a bit like too little, too late.
And that's what I was thinking as well.
The way you laid out is exactly my problem. You know, I have problems with people who don't understand how the system works. You can't build a movement, fund a movement, run an election, and win all at the same time. It's not going to work. You cannot split your energy at this point in so many ways. At this point, if you're considering running a candidate, or candidate considers running, that person should have begun the process quite a while ago, so that you don't start now to figure out who the candidate is going to be. I mean, come on.
And you know what? I had this thought as well, and that's why I wanted to present that too. But the thing was that it's a good strategy if we're going into the next mayoral election. I would say we need to do this right after this election. But I mean, it's something different, something that, you know, like I said, that hasn't been done in decades. And I do appreciate it, but I kind of agree with you in it being maybe a little too late for this.
I think it's a little late, but, you know, what do I know? It's just my opinion. I am thinking that if people really want to get involved in the political arena, they have to understand how it works. But you can't do all of these things at the same time and win. It's not that it is absolutely fated to fail, but it is more than likely that it would fail. So why put yourself in this position over and over and over again? I see candidates coming up and, you know, trying to impress people how great they are. Yes, but you're late. You're late to the whole process. You're late to the party. You're late to the idea of how elections are run. You know, it's frustrating to me. They act like they have no idea how elections work.
That's true. That is true.
So, you know, so come on. What are you trying to do? This is how the establishment has gotten over time and time again. Sometimes you have pretty good and viable candidates who, if they had more time to develop their candidacies, if they had more time to raise money, if they had more time to actually, you know, go out in the community and talk to people, they would have a pretty good chance at winning. But you're starting right practically on the eve of the election, and you have all this work undone, and you expect to win.
And I totally agree with you because, you know, we don't have somebody like Rahm Emanuel who can declare, you know, at the last minute because he has a $50 million coffer to work with.
Exactly.
We don't have that. We don't have that, you know. So he can declare at the last minute and still have a chance to win. But we don't have that.
Because,
and I agree
they're buying their votes. They know exactly where their votes are coming from. They know exactly what they have to do to generate interest, even among people who don't like them. So this is a day late, dollar short political campaign. It's got to end, even if it comes sacrificially. People just have to wake up. You can't enter the fray and start your campaign now. You're crazy.
And that's true. But I do think that this could be a building block if they continue to work on this. Now, if they
stop. We've been talking about building blocks for how long? The fact is, it's the community. The community has to make the demand, and the community has to deliver sanctions. Don't come to us half prepared. It's better that we go with the old Rahm Emanuel model than have half-baked people present themselves as candidates. That's crazy. And we have to stop it. There is no, I mean, you're in Chicago, you know what is going on, you've observed it, and you think you have an idea that you will be a viable candidate. Then get busy. Figure out what it takes to be a candidate, what you will have to do to raise money, how you are going to approach the competition so that you can prevail. You don't just show up as a candidate. It's very infuriating, and that's why we have crappy leadership.
Yeah, and there's people here in Chicago who are just looking for an excuse to vote against Rahm Emanuel, but it's just nobody has stepped up.
And that tells you about the leadership. It has no vision, no vision. It's not preparing a new generation for leadership, and people don't understand and they don't take seriously that politics is a discipline. It's a science. It's not fly by the seat of your pants. You have to know how the system works. And I've long advocated that every community where we know we will eventually have to look to people to pull us through via their political activity, we ought to have a school. People should be going to night classes and or other kinds of classes, formal classes, to understand how you become a candidate. What do you do? Things that you must think about.
Mm-hmm.
This, I am dead serious. I've been talking about this for years. People just show up and say, oh, I want to be a candidate. Well, you're an idiot. Why would I want to elect an idiot?
It's a simple formula, but the execution, for some reason or another, has not been implemented.
We don't want people who decided yesterday or in the last 15 minutes that they want to be a candidate, and it now becomes their personal quest that has nothing to do with the aggregate interests of the community. They're not known in the community, and if they are known, they're not known for doing good.
Mm-hmm.
That politics has become a personal quest. We don't need that kind of politics. I'm sad to hear that Chewy decided he was not going to contest, but, you know, the admonition is the same. Wherever we see potential leadership, we ought to encourage it. And the most important thing that we could do is to educate people about what it takes to run for office, how the party system works, how this entire electoral system works. People have been elected for years, have no clue. And then we have these Johnny-come-latelys when we're on the cusp of an election is when they have a brilliant idea that they ought to run. You're joking, and we don't need jokers. It's better to go with the rotten leadership that you have.
Oh, God.
I know, and make up your mind to do something, because this is a science. It's a scientific fight. You have to have a system in place that protects you, that guarantees that you can actually survive one term. You have to sit down and think about these things. We should end the era of pie in the sky, by and by leadership.
Yeah, and lastly, Nutrice, it took Harold Washington 2 failed elections to win his, so you're absolutely right. It takes time.
It takes time, and it takes a certain amount of integrity. Harold Washington is the textbook example for anybody, not just in Chicago, for anybody contemplating public office.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the old masters, what they did, because they had to fight the party, and they had to fight the other party, and they had to create a path for themselves out of nowhere, which meant they had to immerse themselves in the community. They had to know what the community was about. We just think it's about, you know, we just show up someplace, we put our name on a list saying we want to be candidates, and boom, you're a candidate. No, we've had enough of that. But we also have had stellar examples that we should be using as templates of how we improve our electoral lot. But people are not paying attention to it. Harold Washington, as you said, he didn't win the first time. He had to work at it. And when I say work at it, I mean that he didn't know. There's just this kind of knowledge that is necessary is not readily available. The system keeps it to itself. And so he had to go around the obstacles and form a coalition government, or form coalition effort, I should say, to elect him to office. Brilliant move. But he was dedicated. We don't have people who are dedicated today. We have people who want fame. They want status. They want a regular paycheck, just like their constituents. And that's all they want. So we have to be pretty exacting. The people who show up saying, I want to be a candidate. Well, you know, you tell us in another 5 years whether you're ready. So I hope Chicago, and you know, the thing is that the situation is so desperate in these big cities like Chicago and Washington, D.C., and New York City, and yet we have such mediocrity because people think it's, you know, well, there's a vacuum. I could kind of fill it. Mm-hmm. I'm not qualified. I'm not even interested.
Exactly.
I remember when Grenada was invaded, okay, a congressman from Brooklyn had no idea what Grenada was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, except he had thousands of Grenadians in his district. And he kept calling it Grenada. This is a black congressman. So we have a lot of work to do. And I think we can do it, but we have to do something that is kind of unpleasant, and that is to reject mediocrity. We'd rather you go with what you got rather than bring in new waves of mediocrity. Thanks, Henry, for your call.
All right, thank you. Good to hear from you.
Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Utrice.
Hey, wonderful Harvey. What's up?
Well, I just want to say bless you and your vast progressive radio network audience. And we all love you very much. And since laughter is good medicine, I made up a joke for you.
Okay.
What happens when you tickle a psychic?
I'm laughing already.
You get a happy medium.
Oh, that's a good one. I didn't see that coming.
I'm glad you like that. Well, today I'd like to talk about our worldwide problem with disposable plastic soft drink and water bottles on our streets, along our highways, on our shoreline, and worst of all, in our oceans. And the Great Pacific Plastic Garbage Patch is 4 times larger than the state of California. And in this week's news, there was a dead sperm whale off the coast of Spain with over 60 pounds of plastic in its stomach. We sure are putting a lot of Mother Nature's land and sea creatures in harm's way. And a large part of the problem is that over the years, public drinking fountains have all but disappeared. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's part of a commercial conspiracy on the part of the soft drink and water bottle companies through graft and corruption to have convinced local governments that they could save money by getting rid of public drinking fountains. And unfortunately, these municipalities now have to pay for the cleanup of the plastic water bottle waste and pollution. But the good news is that there's a strong bipartisan support to increase public access to safe, high-quality municipal drinking fountains in schools, parks, public buildings, and around public transport areas. And modern drinking fountains chill and filter the water and let the users refill their glass and stainless steel water bottles. And as far as I'm concerned, public drinking fountains are an important resource, serving as an alternative to bottled water and unhealthy sugary drinks that lead to that lead to tooth decay, obesity, diabetes, as well as another other health problems. And here in California, we have Proposition 65 that requires the state to publish a list of chemicals known to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm. And it turns out that disposable plastic water containers, they contain water bottles, contain chemicals that are listed on Proposition 65. For example, there's a chemical called bisphenol A that's used in water bottle caps, and researchers have discovered that bisphenol A disrupts the endocrine system and can cause miscarriages amongst other health problems. So right now, you have mobile apps that are making it easier to find nearby water fountains, and these apps are currently being developed and tested. So it really is time to get back to municipal drinking water fountains to help stop pollution, stop the polluting of our world with billions and billions of disposable plastic bottles.
Well, I read the account of the sperm whale that died. They said they didn't know for sure that the plastic issue was what made it die. But people are of the opinion that that's what it is. In any event, it is not right that any sea creature should have 64 pounds of plastic. That's a lot of plastic in its system. And you can't even begin to make the case that it's okay. This is a problem that's been growing for a long time, and the major nations of the world have ignored it because they figure, well, you know, it's not floating around in our hemisphere, so why should we be worried about it? And now we have garbage floating around that, as you just rightly said, is its own continent now in some places. There's so much garbage, it's a tantamount to a continent. So what are we going to do? People are not, well, I can't say that they won't be amenable to changing, but they haven't changed enough to give hope that this is something that could be accomplished simply by preaching, you know, the logic of things. When I was growing up in Trinidad, when we go shopping, we take our own bags. You take your own bag. And there was very little waste produced. But now, in Trinidad itself, that no longer exists. You know, because the supermarkets are all Americanized. The thinking is all Americanized. There's so much plastic everywhere, supposedly for the people's convenience. But it has to end up somewhere. It's not going to just vanish. So the smaller countries are glutting themselves with this problem. You have plastics. You have all kinds of corrosive materials posing as, you know, convenient ways to carry your load around. But at the end, it has to go somewhere. If you burn it, you're now sending toxins into the air. If you bury it, it's not going to degrade and be biologically helpful to the soil. So this is a massive problem. I don't know what's in store for us if we don't get this problem understood, and we should stop it. We should stop it. I have seen it, the results. I mean, we have a river that lights up, a whole river lights up in flames because they're just dumping oil into it. How could people live with that? You know, you have to do something. Education is the key, but enforcement is what is needed. People have to be punished for ignoring the catastrophe that they're creating by being careless about the environment. So I agree with you there. Thanks a lot for calling. 888-874-4888. Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor, and I might add, my personal therapist.
You know what?
How are you doing?
Okay. You said you're a professor, and you might add, my personal, and I didn't get the last word.
My personal therapist.
Would you be surprised that it's the other way around?
I owe you quite a few dollars, you know that.
The other way around. What have you to say today,
Jose? Well, I'm here trying to, I'm going to pass something by you, and I know you'll have something to say on it. I don't know if you have seen anything about it. It's something coming out of Britain about the Windrush generation.
Yes.
Well, this is about I guess it's called the Windrush generations because the ship that started the whole thing, that taking Africans from the Caribbean to Britain, was called the Windrush. So they have been, Britain had called out to its colonies to invite them to come to Britain to help to develop the British economy and so on and so forth. And so they called people from the Caribbean, Jamaica, Guyana, Barbados, all over, was heading for, I remember those days as a young man, they were heading off to Britain. They became the working class, the maids, the nurses, the nursing assistants, the janitors, the bus drivers, the truck drivers, whatever. And a few generations down the line, many of those children have become doctors and lawyers and engineers and politicians and so on and so forth. They are settled in Britain and doing fairly decent. And but they got real comfortable. And so now the British government has created the laws are there that is now getting ready to deny many of the folks from the Windrush, they call the Windrush generation, deny them their rights as citizens of Britain. Many of them right now are being denied access to health care. Many are losing their jobs. Many are threatened with deportation. There are incidences where children that was born there have traveled out and is going back to Britain and they're denied entry. And all that type of stuff is happening. And this is going to affect thousands, hundreds of thousands of people from the Caribbean and I assume from Africa also. And so this, to me, is kind of reminding me of what has happened recently in the Dominican Republic, where over 300,000 people in the Dominican Republic, with the blood of Africa coursing through their veins, have been denied citizenship and legal rights in the Dominican Republic, and over 200,000, I believe, was pushed over the border between Dominican Republic and Haiti. And early this year, the Medina, I think his name is, president of the Dominican Republic, was invited to Jamaica, given the red carpet treatment, and he was given one of the highest award from the government of Jamaica under this wholeness regime. And I wonder what kind of people, what is wrong with our people, not knowing what this man, he has presided over a government that has disenfranchised so many of our people. And Jamaica is a country, as far as I know, is 98% people of African ancestry. And to give this man this honor, and all over the world, our people are being denied justice. And so I, as I said, I don't know if you have read anything about the Windrush generation or what is happening, and maybe you could give your comment on what is happening, because the Africans have served their masters well. They have helped to develop their economy and their country and so forth, and now they feel like they have no further need for them. And I have been telling our people here in this country that you shouldn't get too complacent and happy, because the same thing can happen here. As a matter of fact, it has been done before. If you study the history of America, you see where what has happened to immigrants, and especially immigrants of color in this country. So I just want to get your take on...
Yes, but, you know, it is a universal story, especially where people of color are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The people who captured them or lured them or brought them by whatever means, by fair and foul means, to a location.
Yes.
They didn't do it because of the goodness of their hearts. They had plans for mm-hmm. the free labor, and the free labor was to raise the standard of living for others, not for these folks.
Good.
We've been operating quite emotionally on these mm-hmm. questions, I think, mm-hmm. for a very long time. And we want desperately, psychologically, we want desperately to believe that people aren't so evil. They would yeah. never think of doing something like that. But I'll tell you, there are other people who approach it differently.
Yes.
When I was in New York at JFK Airport,
mm-hmm.
people coming from different places, they had their power base already here, mm-hmm. organized to resettle them.
Yeah.
They would be met at the airport. They would be processed at the airport. They mm-hmm. have now, at least back in those days, they had centers throughout Brooklyn, throughout New York, Queens,
yeah.
that processed only Hasidic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You get your food stamps, you get your whatever subsidies, housing subsidies, you get your citizenship papers in, you know, started.
Yes.
And that's what they did. So this was not just the idea of receiving people who were having a problem,
mm-hmm.
living wherever they lived, in Russia, and in other places in Europe. This was the idea of building a new nation.
Mm-hmm.
And they received these people ready to process them at the point of entry. To yeah. this day, in Brooklyn, there are daycare centers your child can't go to.
Mm-hmm.
There are centers specifically and only to process Hasidic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're on welfare, but they get it.
Yes.
And they have a whole system of integration when they land. Where do they live? These are the amenities available to you so that you can begin the process of what? Nation building.
Mm-hmm.
They're not kidding.
Sure.
We didn't think about that. We think that the whole idea is that we are assisting people who are poor. They come to England, the motherland, and, you know, depending on England to dole out in dribs and drabs whatever kinds of benefits they think that they would throw out in order mm-hmm. to keep a stable population of underemployed and unemployed people readily available for exploitation.
Yes.
We did not see the kind of foresight that is necessary. When you have in the Dominican Republic, which it's amazing that people think that the Dominicans are somehow the descendants of Spaniards. You look at a Dominican and you know what the story is.
Yes.
Okay. But you have the ability, from a strategic point of view, to build a nation that would espouse all the good things a nation is supposed to espouse. Equal opportunity for all and so forth. That's not what they were doing. They decided to run a nation according to white supremacist values.
Yes.
And nobody else really in the region, I fault the Caribbean leadership for this. They did not take this on because it's happening everywhere in the Caribbean. You have dualities that have existed for centuries. You don't fix that with just, a new law. You have to fix that with other things, including reparations. You have to make accommodations for the loss of the value of labor given. It's a very complicated thing, but it has to be done that way.
Mm-hmm.
Who is doing it? People expect, well, one day, we should all hold hands and we'll sing, together, and we walk down the street and sing together, and we have achieved. That's not what this calls for. This calls for hard discussions about what is owed to the generations of people who have, at the same time that they are creating possibilities, new possibilities for these colonialist countries, they're also being deprived of the benefits of their contribution.
Yes.
This is a hard discussion. We have to have it.
Sure.
But if you look at New York, quiet as it's kept, tens of thousands every single year through JFK Airport. Or you take another example. Trump wants to build a wall in Mexico. You notice he's not talking about the Canadian border.
No.
And he knows why. Because the Canadian border is vital to the entry of illegal people from Eastern Europe. They're not talking about that. JFK, as I said, they come through there many times with false documents and so forth, but there is a group of people there to meet them. That is exactly how Palestine was abused and became Israel. They packed the country. That's exactly how Crown Heights became a poverty district, something it had never been. They packed the district.
Yes.
So it's a matter of how serious we are. Why is it that the Caribbean community, I'm talking about CARICOM, it is not directly confronting Britain and France and to some degree Spain and all of the other European colonizers with this question of what is owed to Caribbean citizens?
Yes.
Why is the discussion not being held? I know Selwyn, I'm forgetting his last name now, has taken on this question, talking about reparations.
Yes.
But reparations isn't the only thing. It's about living today. Living today. A Caribbean person living today in London should enjoy some degree of a good quality of life based
the fruits
on
of your labor.
Exactly. Based on what has been contributed already for generations.
Yes.
Not a handout is what he or she deserves. That's the kind of conversation we need to have. This is not about Europeans deciding, well, okay, we feel charitable today, and we'll give you a couple of dollars or shillings or whatever it is that will keep you quiet. And the reason they're delaying this is that it's so enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves black folks from all over the world. Not just blacks, actually. People of color from all over the world.
Sure.
So, that is the conversation.
You know, as a Garveyite, I'm fully aware and I understand where we are and what we ought to do. But I just love when you articulate my thoughts.
Well, that's the beauty of the whole thing. We know the truth.
Yes, yes.
You see, we know the truth. And the truth is universal.
Yes. And the charlatans we have in our community are not prepared to stand up with courage and speak the truth.
Well, that's okay, as long as they understand that they reap what they sow.
Yes, yes.
You know, we have a lot of people coming forward now and making demands when they have not participated at all, and they're not interested.
Yes.
In staying in the fight. They just want to pop up and talk nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Jose, for your call.
And as always, me.
Thank you. Willie from Brooklyn.
Good afternoon.
You're going to close us out today.
Good afternoon, our shining star. And good afternoon to the audience, PRN.
Thank you.
Listen, let me ask you this. What's the worst thing one human being could do to another?
Oh, man. I don't know how to answer that because sometimes it's the physical killing of another. And other times, there are other ways in which people can do irreparable harm. So there are many things, many ways in which we do injury to each other.
I know that we could do many things of evil to one another, but I'm asking the worst.
Well, I would say the worst is the annihilation of each other.
Annihilation, okay. Well, that's a part of it. But put in simple terms, I know you are the professor, and I know you make things so simple. You'd have to pay a brass monkey to misunderstand you. So could you put in a simpler term? Yes, it's a part of it. Annihilation, yes, that's correct. But in a simpler term.
Annihilation is more than killing.
No. Wait, Professor. Killing? There are people that some I know, some I don't. You are doing them a favor by killing them. Some people. You know what I'm saying? Because in my judgment, people don't. They don't. You know, they don't kill people. People want to die, and you help them. So there are some people that...
But you asked a question because you have an answer.
Yes. You
have to hurry because we're running out of time.
Oh, God, I didn't realize it was that time. Okay. The worst thing, in my judgment, is to take their mind. Because once you take their mind, you already annihilate them. But just simply by taking their mind. Well, look at your president. Now you're looking for an insane. You know he's insane, and you're looking for an insane leader to provide you with sane leadership. Who's really insane? Think about it.
Yep, it's a little crazy.
Our minds have been taken. Mr. Farrakhan, he did a lecture on the dumbing down of the American people. Everybody should look at that video, that lecture. You'll see, because I watched it with my about 20 years ago. He did that, and I watched it play all out. I watched the whole thing played out. The dumbing down of America. The American mind has been taken. That's why we have Trump. Simple.
Well, thank you. On that note, we conclude the program today. I thank you so much for your very considered opinions. Let's get thinking. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Brasby. And have yourselves a good weekend. We'll join back up with each other on Monday. Bye-bye.